Show on UK Health Radio. My name is Robin Daly and I'm your host for the show and also the founder of the UK registered charity Yes to Life that has for the last 15 years supported people with cancer who want to use integrative medicine. If you're a regular listener, you can't fail to have heard that we're fast approaching our London conference on March the 21st on the topic of nutritional science and cancer. If you're thinking of going, I hope you have a ticket as it's a sellout. And one of the important reasons it's so popular is the world-class lineup of speakers who are tackling all the many facets of this fascinating and hugely important subject. Today, I'm talking to one of those speakers, functional medicine practitioner Victoria Fenton. I'm talking to her over Skype in South Africa, where she's currently on a visit. Hi, Victoria. Great to have you back on the Yes to Life show.
It's great to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
And it's also great that you're one of the many incredible speakers at our London conference on the 21st of March, Nutritional Science and Cancer. Now, you've got a great topic that I'm sure will generate lots of interest, if not outright controversy, navigating the meat, dairy, vegan, vegetarian maze.
Yeah, it's just a little bit daunting because it's a huge, huge topic, but it should be a very interesting one.
Great. So, well, today we're going to start out by tackling one of the thornier issues of our time, killer salad. Now, a recent newspaper headline alerted the public to the unseen dangers lurking in trendy salad leaves. And I'm hoping you're going to be able to bring some reassurance in the face of this troubling news.
I'd use the term fake news if I wouldn't sound a little bit like something I possibly don't want to sound like. But nutritional science, as it's reported in the media, they have to put sensational headlines on because it's a clickbait society. So if we all take everything with a giant pinch of salt, it is more readable, but it's not always easy to take things with a pinch of salt, unfortunately, because what we deal with generally is just the headlines, and digging into the articles doesn't always reveal the science beneath it. If you see what I mean by all of that, you don't get the full information from the articles that you read. So killer salads, there are always oblique truisms in some of what these articles write. This whole rocket trendy salad leaves, everybody's eating tons of carcinogenic nitrates, was the main thrust of the article. It's an interesting thought process in terms of nitrates. They are known to have carcinogenic effects, but nitrates are in a lot of things. So ultimately, what we're looking at when we're trying to assess causal factors is there has to be sufficient evidence to suggest that something has caused something. In this case, can nitrates in salad cause cancer? As your audience will know, cancer is it's a huge topic. There isn't just one cancer. There isn't just one cause of cancer. It is so multidimensional and multifaceted that to make claims that anything causes cancer is a huge extrapolation, and it has to be. So that's kind of a universal default.
Right.
The important vital issue of whether trendy rocket leaves are going to cause cancer, it's basically nonsense.
Right. Okay.
And the reason it's nonsense is because nitrates exist everywhere. They exist in plants, soils, water, etc. They're talking about the concentration of this kind of chemical in green leafy vegetables. It's a bit like the whole spinach debate about whether that causes thyroid cancer, etc. The quantity massively matters. So there are certain plants which can accumulate lots of levels of nitrates from soil, and those chemicals have been reported to have a link to, in particular, actually gastrointestinal cancers. But there's no link between eating rocket and gastrointestinal cancer.
All right.
So they've kind of added two together and got to 25 million. It's that much of an extrapolation. It's huge. And it is all it's saying is that certain levels of these plants are starting to accumulate more nitrates from soil. Could this be an issue because nitrates are known to have a carcinogenic effect in massive levels and go on to have a contributory effect to gastrointestinal cancer? There is zero evidence that lettuce causes cancer.
Right.
So keep eating salad.
Right, keeping the salad. So this is a kind of simplistic science that basically jumps to conclusions based on two separate pieces of information which have truth in them, but joining them together is not really a reasonable hypothesis.
Absolutely not. And I mean, this article would have been quite interesting if they'd have said, oh, we're finding a higher level of nitrates in rocket than we used to, and stopped there. But that's not newsworthy. That's just an interesting science article. So in order to make it newsworthy, they have to make the second extrapolation. And that's common for particularly these online kind of Daily Mail online kind of articles. I can say that because it is often the Daily Mail that does this.
It is.
But it just makes reading nutritional science the higher priority. But patients and busy people and those who are really they don't have time to be a PhD researcher as well as have a life. We get left with these kind of clickbait articles, unfortunately.
Well, another article that I think really highlights what you're saying, in as much as I feel it's actually got some useful information in it that gets completely lost in the headline, is the one about the lady, a terminal cancer patient, who only had to turn to a kitchen cupboard staple to find the answer. And this is the curry spice article. Now, you know, this is sensationalized headline that actually is sort of burying the good information that there might be about curcumin.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've looked a lot into curcumin as a substance simply because it is well known to have properties that are very beneficial for health. It's right. Anti-inflammatory. There's a suite of stuff that it does for the body, and it acts in many different ways. But to then say anything cures cancer, etc., or anything is part of this massive resolution, particularly when you're dealing with something like curcumin, is a very difficult it's a very difficult road to walk, because again we're back at the common thought process that cancer is not just one thing. So this lady's cancer might be completely different to anybody else's cancer, and it's not really discussed that this is a lot of different things that we're talking about. So that's one element of this.
Mm-hmm.
The second element is that curcumin isn't just one thing. So curcumin is the compound, and curcuminoids are the compounds found in turmeric. So to say that this lady took turmeric powder from the spice cupboard and just ate loads of it and resolved cancer, I'm pretty sure that's not what she was doing, because you need massive levels of turmeric, and I mean massive levels, like indigestible levels of turmeric, to be able to have any impact on inflammation at all. So for example, when I'm recommending curcumin to my patients, I'm not recommending that they go and eat a load of curry. I'm recommending that they take curcumin as a supplement where it's measured and it has certain elements within those capsules typically to stop the liver just flushing out the curcumin, which it can do really quickly.
Right.
And that's just adding in something like black pepper. So it's quite a complicated human biochemistry thought process is how you can leverage curcumin to help with a lot of conditions such as inflammation. The slightly different element of this is that they have found in populations that consume higher levels of turmeric just naturally in the diet, and by that I do mean the turmeric that you're going to put in curries, etc., incidences of cancer overall are a small amount lower. So what we've got is, again, some truth, some interesting anecdotal evidence of one patient, and then the media jumping on it as if it's the best thing since, you know, chemotherapy was invented, that suddenly turmeric is going to replace every other treatment for cancer ever. And it just, the evidence doesn't stack up. But as you pointed out, it's such a dangerous world because there is some evidence for the use of curcumin in inflammatory conditions.
So here the tabloid headline is playing against the potential that curcumin genuinely has, which is as some part of an integrative program.
Completely. And I think that's the thing with everything that, as a natural integrative physician, I would approach cancer from a very holistic perspective, as we spoke about last time. It's sort of, there's a lot more than just one thing that I would do. And curcumin can be a very integral part of that. But I am never going to say to a patient, look, just take this turmeric capsule and take 10 of them a day, please.
Right.
We'll have success.
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. So those last two were fine examples of the black and white kill or cure mentality behind tabloid reporting. As you mentioned, it's just not newsworthy unless it's sensational. But probably the most frustrating variety of these are the kill and cure ones. The same newspaper will happily report the dangers of something one week and its life-saving properties the next. And the results just kind of utter confusion for the public and leading to total disinterest and apathy regarding the risks and benefits that could be genuine, and they're just getting lost in the hype. So I wanted to just talk about a few of the ones that get both sides of the picture regularly and see if we can clarify, get a few facts out of the mess here. I want to start out with caffeine. You know, tea and coffee, they regularly get the rap between being lifesavers and being death in a cup.
Tea and coffee are interesting, and they're actually different things. So obviously, I mean, that sounds like a silly thing to say, but they are different things.
Right.
And this just roots back to nutrition is complex, and the biochemical properties of a compound have diverse impacts in human physiology. It's why it's complicated. So there are certain compounds in both tea and coffee, actually more specifically tea has things called catecholamines in, which can lower inflammation, do all sorts of adaptogenic things to the body, which is a sort of loaded term again, but ultimately can improve detoxification in certain cases and just support physiology. Caffeine too, there are compounds within it which, when applied in the right settings, can actually just support physiology, particularly the liver, particularly actually, you know, brain chemicals and focus, etc. So there are good things about these substances, which is why you can read an article proclaiming that there's good things about them. But as with every substance, it's kind of, I think of things about Goldilocks zones. So it's not too cold, not too hot, but just right.
Right.
It's exactly the same. So when you're thinking about tea and coffee, they're actually stimulants. So it's not that you should drink tea throughout the day, because then your body will be driving on a bit too much cortisol, which is stressful and therefore inflammatory. You may not sleep at night, which sleep is one of the best things for human physiology just universally. So if you're knocking off your sleep because you're trying to drink more caffeine or more of these compounds, you're kind of taking away in a different area. So it isn't that any one of these substances is going to cure anything, but as part of a healthy approach to life in general, the odd cup of tea and coffee is not going to do any harm. Whether it's going to, kill or cure is the modern press needs to be so black and white. There has to be a dichotomy. The reality is that kind of nutrition exists in shades of grey. So it isn't kill and it isn't cure. And it's about dose and the person that you're talking about. So when is the dose applied? How much is it applied in? And is that suitable for that specific patient?
So moderation. But as you point out, the you know, if it's somebody who's got cancer, they might take precautions that somebody who's healthy wouldn't.
Yes, and there are, and this is what worries me about the modern media when it comes to cancer, is that some people are pushed into fear of certain substances because there is this will give you cancer narrative. So I often see patients in my practice where they are frightened about way more than they need to be frightened about. So
right.
A common kind of, this will stray into the kind of topic that I'll talk about at the conference, but there is this kind of, oh my God, I can't have meat, it will cause cancer.
Right.
And there's so much that is direct link that shouldn't be. So most of my work with cancer patients in the first kind of session that I have with them is decreasing some of the fear about some of these substances.
So many of these things come from these sort of large population studies, don't they, where they find out, they conclude that, you know, eating something or another raises your risk of cancer by 70%. And it's very impersonal, though, isn't it? It has nothing to do with what race you are, where you live, what you eat, all these different factors that can affect whether that the particular substance affects you badly or not are simply not in the picture.
So, yeah, I mean, it's very true that epidemiology and epidemiological science is not patient-specific, but it's super valuable.
Right.
And I think as nutrition professionals, we need to be very aware that perfect randomized control trials that you can do for a drug are not possible within the nutritional realm. They just aren't. It's too complex. So within that, epidemiology is super important. But having an interpretation on that, which respects exactly what you said, it's not necessarily population specific to the person reading it. There are huge amounts of variables. There's a healthy user bias often in these studies, where people who are making choices to do one thing are often making a set of other choices,
right,
which aren't always factored out in the analysis. And the other factor is that when they report risk, there's a drastic difference between absolute risk and relative risk.
Right.
And these things are things that people in the nutritional world don't even understand sometimes. And reading science is a skill set in and of itself. And my feeling is that no patient should be expected to be a science researcher or a reader of science and understand this. Therefore, the onus is on either the producers of the scientific papers or the people who are reporting them, so the press, or there's a lot of nutritional kind of people on social media who will report these studies, and they have to really make it clear whether it's talking about absolute risk or relative risk. And you know, the rise of a percentage point in an epidemiological study may mean absolutely nothing, or it may mean a heck of a lot, and having the right people talk about it so that patients have the layman's terms version of it is hugely valuable, in my opinion.
Sadly, when it comes to tabloid media, though, there's no sense of responsibility there to actually provide the public with accurate information. It's all about selling newspapers, and therefore sensationalism wins out every time over actual truth here. And so if a newspaper headline causes a lot of people to do something which is unhealthy or avoid something which is healthy, they don't really care at the end of the day. It's much more about, well, did it do a good job selling our newspaper?
And I have to be very careful, and you're absolutely right. There is they go on sales or clicks, whichever media you're in. I would be wary to attribute that to malice. I don't think they're trying to do health harm to people. I do think it's just a lack of truly thinking through the consequences of writing a huge story line that's basically a headline. Oftentimes, if you do read carefully through the article, they do kind of moderate their stance.
Right.
But they're not recognizing, they don't read the article. They're just looking at headlines. And it's sometimes science is confusing, and sometimes papers reporting one thing one day and another thing another day isn't because they're trying to confuse the population. It's because they just don't get that one study does not a conclusion make. There has to be a weight of evidence. But because there is such a published need for papers and for scientists, actually, we get a lot more data than we get information. And information takes a bit more time to actually come through. And that's what we're looking for when we're looking for how do we help a patient population. So my feeling is that scientific researchers, nutrition professionals, doctors, we should all be working together to make information a quicker turnaround, so that from data we can actually get proper useful tools to then help patients. But it's just not quite happening.
Right, I understand. Yeah, well, I would agree with you. I don't think it's malice as such. It's just simply that their attention isn't on accuracy or anything else. It is on the business of news, and hence the lack of accuracy. Okay, back to my hit list. What about vitamins? They always get. I mean, I'm lumping them all together here, but as a group of items, they get some pretty good coverage in both directions as killers and lifesavers.
It's another really complicated territory. Digging me difficult questions. So vitamins are essential for life. Can you get them all from food, as in nutrients from food? That would be the ideal. Do people? Often not, and that can be through food availability. There's a huge socioeconomic divide. If you can't afford really nutritious vegetables, etc., then you aren't always getting all the nutrients that you need. But then you get the certain nutrients which are single, or vitamins which are singled out as lifesavers.
Yeah.
I think one of the ones that we were thinking about was vitamin C, where you can read that it does nothing. You can read that you shouldn't be taking massive doses of it, or you can read that actually it's a panacea. It cures pretty much everything. There is evidence to suggest that because of one of the ways that vitamin C works, that as a part of cancer therapy, it can be quite important in a very specific way. So this isn't you buying a pot of vitamin C from Boots and thinking that you taking one a day is going to help with a lot, to be honest. This is, there is an alternative or a functional medicine approach to cancer which uses vitamin C infusions, so intravenous vitamin C. The application is quite specific, and it really must come at a specific time in conjunction with other treatments. It's just to do with the way that vitamin C can create a reaction in cancer cells and healthy cells, actually. But it's an exposure to both vitamin C and oxygen, which can tip a cell over into cell senescence, so death, basically. It's complicated. It isn't simple. It shouldn't be applied by the public just generally, like popping vitamin C capsules. It is a very specific treatment approach. So that's why you get confusion in articles where vitamin C does nothing. Yes, they're probably talking about, you know, your ascorbic acid that you buy in a supplement, versus vitamin C can really make a difference in certain cancers, in certain cases, applied in a very specific way. So that's where that confusion comes from.
Yeah, well, just to weigh in on that particular one, well, of course, we, Yes Alive, we've got our own experience. We've been Daily Mailed on this one, and we had to deal with the old ripping off dying cancer patients and no evidence whatsoever line for the fact that we have information about vitamin C on our website. You know, there was very little recourse, of course, to say anything about it. Otherwise, they did publish a very small paragraph at the bottom from me to say actually what we're doing here. And but the thing that's really stunning about it is that having done this complete sensational, you know, revelation about a charity and abusing the public, they happily subsequently published vitamin C could halt the growth of cancer, high doses of vitamin C can help to battle cancer, antibiotics and vitamin C could kill cancer cells, and could vitamin C jabs cure cancer? That, you know, four articles that followed it up, which are like completely the opposite, which actually saying what we're saying. Well, yes, there is potential there for vitamin C in some cases. So that's why we have the information.
Because printing retractions is never something that's done in the same blaze of glory as printing up the sensationalist article to begin with. But there just seems to be such cognitive dissonance in the media where they can print one thing one day and another thing another day and not even grasp that they are completely sort of about facing on their own claims.
Exactly.
And, you know, to be honest, vitamin C is relatively benign. I know it sounds like a terrible thing to say, but if I was a patient who'd just been given a cancer diagnosis and I was looking at what do I want to do on a daily basis, there's some very drastic solutions presented out there, and there's some really quite simple ones. So having said that taking a daily dose of vitamin C won't necessarily cure cancer, it doesn't mean that I don't want vitamin C in my general life. And I probably would. You know, personally take a very few supplements. Some vitamin C is one of them, just generally. It's nice to have it in my life. And that's not a general recommendation, and I'm not prescribing over the internet, etc. But it is this kind of, sometimes we have to just take a really cold, rational look at what is the impact of the recommendations that the modern press are giving. And it's very easy for them to have an attack phase and a kind of accusing a charity of doing something negligent. It's a lot easier to do that than to actually look at what is actually being said and the dangers of what's being said.
Yeah, well, the dangers from my perspective, knowing some of the science there is behind vitamin C, and knowing that, for example, there is decent trials from Canada showing that for pancreatic cancer, they're doubling life expectancy simply by adding vitamin C, high dose vitamin C, to standard treatment. The fact that that information might be kept away from people because of crappy newspaper headlines is a tragedy. Really, it's absolutely awful. But I'm pleased to say that the heartening bit is that by far the majority of the public comments below the article are actually in favour of choice and this information being put out, and not in support of the article.
And it's interesting because these are very much in addition to conventional treatment.
Yes.
And I think that that's the thing that people miss a lot of the time. There is an argument between the kind of food is medicine crowd and the food is not medicine crowd. Very few people in the nutritional world really say food is medicine. Not the moderates anyway, not the people who have their heads screwed on properly. But what we are saying is that as part of a unified strategy, nutrition, vitamins, supplements can actually drastically alter the course of an illness. And in that way, if people listen to what is actually being said and just take a breath before jumping to all the conclusions, a lot of this melodrama would be avoided. But as we've said so many times, sensationalism sells. So the melodrama will always win. And, you know, you can start a war on Instagram by saying, you know, food might help with something. You learn what to avoid.
Okay, so now can we, from my list, can we go to something which is a bit more in the drug area? Aspirin has been bounced between being something everybody should be taking every day to stay alive and something that, again, is extremely bad for you. So where do you think the truth lies on that one?
So, disclaimer first, I'm not a doctor and I don't prescribe anything, but obviously you can buy aspirin over the counter.
Exactly.
So, this is a really patient-specific thing. There are certain patients for whom a daily aspirin is recommended, mainly cardiovascular risk factors, etc. And that kind of puts a certain patient population in getting that recommendation. But actually what's happened in modern medicine is that has got extrapolated far further than the population where it was proved to be effective. Aspirin is known to cause a slight gastrointestinal bleed every time you take it, which sounds extreme and is quite extreme. I'm a natural physician. I don't like the thought process of taking something every day that's a drug, because drugs and pharmaceuticals have a very specific chemical impact, which is not without side effects. Those side effects can be mild and do nothing, and in vast swathes of the population, that will stay true. But they can also be more than that. And that's the grey area in which we don't really know. Always discussing this stuff with your physician is the right choice, but whether they have the knowledge to know that aspirin is not a universal, it's not universally safe, it is a medication, it is not, it's not going to do miracles for everybody, but it is, it does have slight benefits in certain patient populations, providing there is enough other health going on within their regimen. So again, it's complicated. These aren't one word answers and yes, you should or no, you shouldn't. It's you are an individual, assess everything from an individual basis and assess the risk factors based on your genetics, your family history and what you have going on.
Right.
But that's way too nuanced for me.
It is. It's that grey area you were talking about. a couple more quickies. How about sun exposure? That one's been both ways.
God. So sun exposure is very healthy for you because you get lots of vitamin D if you can synthesize it from the sun. But should you stay in the sun long enough to burn? Absolutely not. Can you use sunscreen without risk? Most definitely. And that's a common one that gets bandied around as in, like, sunscreen's going to give you cancer. Preferably not all of the toxicity ones. But, you know, if you're living in the UK, being outside in the sun for 20 minutes in the height of the sun in summer is still not going to give you any problems. There are people for whom they have higher risk factors. So if skin cancer runs in the family, if there are other health issues going on, their risk is higher. But universally, sun is not a bad thing. And it's actually a very good thing. It's very nourishing to a lot of systems, particularly with its role for vitamin D. But that doesn't mean you need to be baking and spending hours and hours and hours in it.
A few years back, you might have thought the sun was put up there specifically to kill us. But I'm glad to hear it's got better press these days generally. It's actually rather good for us. And of course, we're built for it rather than not. What about wine and alcohol?
Alcohol is a toxin. And it will always be a toxin. It affects the liver. And actually, when you take in anything, if you're taking in alcohol as part of that, the liver will have to deal with the alcohol first. But alcohol is also a social agent. It helps people relax a little bit, although it possibly shouldn't be used like that. And I think that a moderate approach, and this is personal opinion, this is what I apply in my practice, a moderate approach is probably useful. If you are suffering from cancer now, and you are either in treatment or in a phase of recovery, I think that adding alcohol into your life is something that you should do with caution, because it is something that is a slight stressor to the body and will cause your body to have to think about something else and detoxing something else, as well as potentially drugs that you're taking, etc., etc. Can things like red wine and resveratrol cure anything? So that's actually two different questions. Red wine can't. There's not enough resveratrol in red wine to make a massive amount of difference. And all the sort of population studies you read about Mediterranean diets, and they contain loads of red wine, so it must be part of a healthy regimen. There's so many factors involved in why people in the Mediterranean are healthy, and red wine is probably not a key factor.
Right.
Can resveratrol help supplementation? Yes, but it's another loaded question and has to be done quite carefully under the guidance of physicians. Alcohol itself is something that is definitely something that should be in and out of your life, depending on how healthy the rest of your body and your system is, in my opinion.
Hmm. All right. So again, it's a kind of nuanced picture with moderation as being the guiding light.
Yeah. And, you know, whether that's the units per week that the government recommend or not is kind of, it's not really about that. It's about how much is your body dealing with. And it should always be borne in mind that alcohol, and this goes too for coffee and other substances like this, they're not essential. They are not providing any nutritional value particularly. So they are adding a little bit of stress and yet also sometimes social pleasure and happiness. And when you're looking at stress as a spectrum, having happiness, socializing with friends, feeling like you're having fun with that kind of social setting, and if it's part of that, it's an entirely different question to sitting drinking a glass of wine on your own at home at the end of a workday.
Right. Interesting. I note the contrast between the fact that, I mean, current advice seems to be going towards the fact that no amount of alcohol is good for you. Basically, you know, that you should avoid it, essentially, if you possibly can. And that's on the one side. But on the other side, we have the Blue Zone research, which I find very interesting, about the people who are the longest living and how they live. And I think it's pretty uniform to say that they all do what you recommend, which is a moderate amount of alcohol.
Yeah. And Blue Zone research is interesting. And I work in the longevity world. So obviously Blue Zone research is something that I do look at quite a bit.
Mm.
Again, it is so multifactorial. And looking at the way they live, they're not, working ridiculous hours in a modern westernized society with lots of exposure to toxins and chemicals, etc., in their daily life, and also having a glass of wine at night watching Netflix.
Mm.
That's not the way they're consuming alcohol.
Right.
So actually, when we look at Blue Zones, and when I look at Blue Zones, I'm very much keeping an incredibly broad perspective, knowing that socialization is one of those it doesn't get as much press as it should for how health making it is.
Mm.
So sleep is now getting a lot more research towards it, and people are starting to talk about how sleep is so important. The next phase that I hope people walk towards is socialization, sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, and a sense of community. And when I look at Blue Zone research, that is a unifying factor. People are living in tribes, it takes a village society, so when somebody's not well, other people step in. It's a very communal environment, and alcohol is consumed as part of that, that kind of approach to just generally being in a tribe. Modern kind of government science research is not researching alcohol in that setting. It's researching the literal toxicity of ethanol in the liver and what impact does it have on the human physiology. There's so much about that socialization, sense of purpose, even if that purpose is that you get up in the morning and you've got to till that field and that's what you're doing that day. That sense of being kind of totally at one with your world and in your network is hugely health making. And I think that is a confounding variable whenever you start looking at Blue Zone research and what do they do. It's not that you can take all of their practices and just slap them into, high-rise flat in the centre of the UK.
Right.
It's not the same. Doesn't
translate. Interesting. So in fact, you're saying that both pieces of evidence are true within their own context.
100%, yeah.
Hmm. But it's really good to hear you talking about these things in the area of socialisation, the purpose, belonging, community, and, about how important those actually are to our health in every way.
It's fundamental. I think that the one thing that we forget, and it's relevant to say in terms of cancer, is that the causational factors for cancers are always a set of stressors. And I'm using the word stressors very, very broadly. So maybe it's the carcinogenic nitrates. It's probably not, but that might be a tiny bit as a stressor. And more of the stressors, the toxins, the chemicals, whatever it is that's part of the stressor reaction, inflammation that's underlying everything, is part of the network of issues which create cancers.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at stressors and you're looking at the way modern life is lived, not having that community support, not feeling like you're living your purpose, feeling a sense of disconnection or just being slightly divorced from life or not understanding where you fit, all of these things become stressors. Subtle ones, maybe, but when you look at the multifactorial stressor combinations that give rise to illness of any description, that has to be a part of our thought process. It really does, because, we're starting to talk about mental health more, and it is that kind of thought process that feeling connected to human beings is such a fundamental part of being a human being. And the more we miss that in a health perspective, the less we're focusing on the total picture of what makes us healthy as humans.
Hmm. Really, really glad to hear you say all that stuff. I'm completely with you. Okay, we're going to skip over one or two in the interest of time. Dairy out, HRT out, soya out. But I do want to have a quick word about low carb, because the low carb, and particularly, of course, Atkins, have really had the kill or cure treatment. So do you want to just pick that apart a little bit?
Yeah, I can. Realistically, we could spend days talking about low carb. And there's a huge difference, again, between a low carbohydrate nutritional approach and what Atkins became known as, which was the bacon and butter diet, which is a way to do high fat eating and low carb eating, but it's not the only way. nutrition is interesting in that macronutrients and micronutrients do make a difference to cellular biology. They just do because they have to, because that's the fuel that our body's using to make energy and to live. There are a lot of extreme diets out there. So low carb now is typically the ketogenic diet is where people end up researching, which is extremely high fat. That has to be sort of 80% fat. And that's very difficult to do. You're either in ketosis or you're not. And it's not advisable for the general population because it's that hard to do. And it just to be nutritionally complete whilst doing that is very difficult.
Right.
Additionally, is it necessary? Is it required? There is a weight of evidence behind the fact that being sort of low carbohydrate and having the ability to use fat as fuel is probably a better way to say it. So you're not reliant on glucose all the time. There is a good deal of anecdotal evidence starting to come through that going into a chemotherapy treatment, being able to use fat as fuel actually supports recovery immediately after it. Mechanism isn't fully explored. It could be something to do with the way cancer cells in certain cancers are thought to use sugar as fuel, as in glucose as fuel. Cancer is it's so many different things. So applying low carb because all cancers feed off sugar to every single cancer is not the right way to think about it. And it's very much, and sorry, it's another nuanced picture. And it does depend on the type of cancer, the way your metabolism is driving things generally, and how well you function energetically by lowering the carbohydrates in your diet. That is a conversation about carbohydrates. If you're talking about sugar, as in refined and processed sugar, that's always going to be a little bit of a roller coaster for the human body. And that, I would suggest, in a disease state, which is essentially what cancer is not the most sensible thing to be fueling your body with. But when you're talking about carbohydrates, you expand that to a bigger picture, such as rice, potatoes, starchy vegetables, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they can form a part of a very healthy diet, providing that everything else is in check. And cancer is interesting in that certain cancers have a lot of protein drivers. So people who go into ketosis or ketogenic diet start eating tons of protein, and that can have negative consequences. So in essence, my guidance is always speak to somebody who knows what they're talking about and get a specific recommendation for your cancer and your status within where you are in treatment, diagnosis, etc.
Okay, usual story. Could be good for some people. There have been various words and terms and phrases have come up all the way through this. You know, it's complicated. It's definitely one of them. And nuance and moderation, all this sort of thing. Do you want to just summarise for the people, apart from the advice which some people would give, which is to keep well away from the news, but apart from that piece of advice, what's your summary of ways to take in this kind of news or ways to tease out the truth out of it, maybe?
Sure. So having slammed all of the kind of modern press and media, there are several key people who talk about nutrition science a lot online in their various platforms and do a good job of debunking these kinds of stories. I'd definitely be interested, if I was dealing with something like this, in following those people, just because the translation field is something that we need, because it's complicated, as I keep saying. So, firstly, never believe a headline.
Right.
Secondly, if you read an article and think it sounds a little bit ridiculous, it probably is, respect that there will be a grain of truth somewhere,
okay,
and then see if anybody else is talking about it. So I learned this very early on in my kind of nutritional research world. It's like if one thing gets said, you can pretty much ignore it. If it keeps being said, there may be some more truth to it. And it's at that point where just a gentle look online, and I can send you the resources, Robin, later about the people who I would suggest are good at this, in terms of disseminating the right information.
Thank you.
Because we do need more than one authority, and they are available. People are talking about this. And, you know, I'm a nutrition consultant, I still ask the researchers for information because I don't have the time to be across all the research all the time.
Mm.
But the major thing that I would say to any patient who's looking on cancer research stuff is that no matter what an article says, you are an individual. Not everything is universal. There's so much nuance. And if you want support, there are a lot of practitioners and professionals who are talking about this and are willing to support people with cancer or anywhere within that diagnosis, friends and family members, because it's a huge thing in our society. And it matters that nuanced approach is given because patients deserve it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good advice. Thank you. And thanks very much for calming the waters around killer salad and throwing light on all sorts of other tabloid drivel today. Yeah, and I hope the rest of your trip in South Africa goes really well. And I look forward to seeing you at our conference on the 21st of March.
I am coming back specially for that conference, so I very much look forward to it.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, thanks so much, Victoria.
Thanks.
Well, that was a fun topic, but one with a serious side, as our tabloids have much to answer for when it comes to confusion amongst the public, if not outright apathy generated by sensationalist reporting. Victoria mentioned some myth-busting science people that she would recommend to link to on Instagram. A couple of those are @thenutritional_advocate. With story highlights on saturated fat, randomized controlled trials, and how to read science, especially nutritional science. And also @DrJoshuaWolrich, that's Joshua WOLRICH, Joshua Walrich, with story highlights on red meat and cancer, etc., and celery juice myth nonsense. Thanks a lot for listening. I hope you'll want to join me again to listen to another speaker from our upcoming conference on next week's Yes Live show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.